Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1885, the country's first playground was conceived of in Boston, Massachusetts. Consisted entirely of a pile of sand, and it was a big hit. The sand gardens, as they were called, gave kids a safe place to play away from Boston's busy streets. Soon, swings and seesaws were added to the mix, and what is now known as the playground movement was birthed. The playground has continued to evolve, incorporating everything from recycled tires to works of art. Today, playgrounds are made up of colorful plastic equipment, short slides, and soft surfaces that emphasize safety. Environments that some critics say make for a tame, homogenous play experience that could actually stunt kids' sense of thrill and adventure. Here to fill us in on the past and future of playgrounds is Ruth Graham. She's a New Hampshire-based writer and frequent contributor to the Boston Globe Ideas section, where we found her article, How the American Playground Was Born in Boston. Ruth, great to have you with us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So first, let's go back to those first sand piles in Boston. Where did the idea come from?
Well, it came from anxiety. So you have, as cities are expanding in the 19th century, there's this concern by a lot of experts that kids are no longer getting exercise, they're no longer getting fresh air and the opportunity to run around wild in nature. And then you also have this concurrent anxiety of what kids are up to when they're running wild in the streets. Kids with time on their hands is sort of a perennial anxiety. So from that, there's this idea that we need to build something to occupy these kids and give them the opportunity to play. So the sand gardens come from Germany, where a lot of progressive child development ideas are coming
that's
from
the 19th century.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's imported to Boston. And it's this philanthropic group that decides, let's just give it a try. And they dumped a pile of sand in the yard of a chapel in an immigrant neighborhood in the North End, actually. And it's a huge hit. So it's that first one, that first pile of sand is mostly for toddlers, and they're supervised, and they have little wheelbarrows that they're playing with. But it's a huge hit, and it expands really rapidly, and soon you're getting playground equipment and older kids, and it just really takes off from there.
And by the mid-20th century, we have playgrounds as popular as ever with exciting and fresh designs. Tell us a little bit about this kind of golden age, I guess, of the playground.
Yeah, so within that first few decades, you have the really standard equipment, jungle gyms and tall slides and things like that. But really, within a few decades, you're getting the sculptor Isamu Noguchi is designing some really modern, advanced, fascinating equipment. That's, if you can find those photos online, it's really kind of amazing. And in the mid-1950s, the Museum of Modern Art in New York sponsors a playground design competition that really spurs a lot of creativity. And the other great thing about the equipment of the 50s and 60s is you're really seeing this kind of space age energy. So there are robots and, there's rocket ships and lunar landers. You really get this kind of distinct, exciting design in that era that we don't see anymore.
But it wasn't long before the playground started being upgraded with safer, more innocuous equipment, and sand began to disappear. So what was behind these changes?
Well, there are a couple of high-profile injuries in the 1970s. So, there's at least one kid that's falling off a tall slide and getting hurt on this concrete, the concrete
Underneath,
yeah. Exactly. You have consumer advocates emerging. One of them's comparing playgrounds to Russian roulette. And so there's this anxiety, some of it very understandable, and others, there's this really extreme backlash to the kind of riskier equipment at that time. And then the Consumer Product Safety Commission comes out with guidelines in the early 1980s. So what you have in the 80s and 90s is really just the phasing out of all the wild and wacky and dangerous equipment. So you see guardrails everywhere. You see equipment shrinking. You see the loss of climbing opportunities. Slides are shrinking. Swings are going away. And sand, too, as you said, is disappearing. In large part because of a paranoia about junky needles. You can picture this sort of 80s uh-huh. frenzy over drug use. And again, I don't want to say that never happened, but it really is pretty overblown. It's not that there's an actual epidemic of kids being stuck by junky needles in sand, but there's a fear of it. And fear drives a lot of those changes.
Fear and lawsuits.
Exactly, exactly.
So we have this rubber padded playgrounds, loads of tunnels, very low to the ground, and a share of critics, some of whom you spoke to, who say they're tame. One in particular said she called today's playgrounds the McDonald's model. Now, what's behind her criticism?
Yeah, can't you picture that exactly? You know, anyone who's ever been to a McDonald's knows what that means. Well, there's this pendulum, if you think of a pendulum between adventure and safety on playgrounds, and the pendulum in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, it's swinging just all the way towards safety. So playgrounds are predictable, they're cushioned, they don't give kids opportunities for exercise. You know, they become the symbol of everything that's wrong with contemporary childhood. And this, you know, this backlash to helicopter parenting and this feeling that kids aren't allowed to be kids anymore. So it's this better safe than sorry model that a lot of experts are saying is just, it's not ideal, that we've swung too far to one end of the pendulum.
No, so we're swinging along the pendulum of history and the playground with Ruth Graham. She's a New Hampshire-based writer. She wrote about how the American playground was born in Boston for the Boston Globe Ideas section. So, right, we get this narrative, right, of the risk-averse, you know, coddled child. So what's developing then? Where's the pendulum swinging to next for the next generation of playgrounds?
Well, it is swinging back, and that's the good news for a lot of people. But it's not that we're going back to this era of sky-high metal slides over concrete. But we are there are a couple of themes. So one is playgrounds that are patterned after nature. So instead of just being on a flat concrete slab, it's playgrounds that are built around hills and boulders and trees and really incorporating the natural environment. One of the neat things about slides built into hills is it gives kids this feeling of perilous, risky, tall slides, but without the actual risk of cracking your head open on concrete. Another theme is this idea of loose parts, which is kind of a trendy playground term that includes big blocks and tools like those early sand gardens had and sand itself. So just movable parts that just give kids a lot more play options and opportunities for creativity than the McDonald's model do. Mm-hmm. So things are changing.
Well, looking into this, you found that Europe is, surprise, surprise, in general, more experimental about the playgrounds. Talk about some of the really adventurous things that we would be, I don't know, scratching our heads over playgrounds developing there.
It's kind of amazing. So in Europe, there are these adventure playgrounds, which is a fancy way of saying junkyards for kids, where kids are able to, they set tires on fire, they're hammering nails into, you know, old pieces of wood and getting splinters, and they're splashing in mud. And there is a paid supervisor there who, you know, is reassuring to parents, but at the same time does not get truly involved, and it really is sort of a chaotic, crazy experience. But unsurprisingly, kids love it, mm-hmm. And they've been popular in Europe for decades. So there's obviously not a huge injury issue there. Although I think there's also a little bit of a different attitude toward injury. I interviewed a child development expert in Norway who said, you know, here when kids, if a child is playing and they fall and they break their arm, that's something that happens when a child is truly playing over the course of a childhood. And in the United States, if a kid breaks their arm, that's a sign that something has gone horribly wrong and something that needs fixing. So there's a different attitude, not to idealize Europe as we so often do, but there is just a different attitude toward play.
So Ruth, what do you think? You know, after looking at this, are we overthinking what kids need to play? I mean, basically, you can set them outside with a box usually, and that works for a while.
You can. I mean, kids will play with anything. They'll play anywhere. But at the same time, playgrounds are this opportunity to do so much more than what we've been doing with them for the last couple of decades at least. So if we're going to have playgrounds, and I think everyone agrees we should, then why not make them exciting and great and fun?
Without the fires.
Without the fires, yeah.
Ruth Graham, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ruth Graham, a freelance writer. She's based in New Hampshire, contributes to the Boston Globe Ideas section frequently, among other publications. You'll find a link to read her article, How the American Playground Was Born in Boston. There's also a terrific slideshow of playgrounds through the ages. Links at wordofmouthradio.org.
Coming up, we're going to continue our trip into the great outdoors, beginning with your own backyard. Stay with us for that when Word of Mouth continues from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're exploring the great outdoors. From New Hampshire's abundant transfer stations to what Ansel Adams' striking photographs of the Sierra Nevadas inspired. But first, for most folks, experiencing the great outdoors happens most often in their own backyard. Or as Julie Moyer-Mesurvey would encourage us, the front yard, the side yard, that shady corner, that empty space along the wall, all holding the potential for beautiful landscapes. Julie Moyer-Mesurvey is a landscape designer, author, lecturer, and principal of the Julie Moyer-Mesurvey Design Studio in Saxton's River, Vermont. She's out with a new practical guide called Landscaping Ideas That Work. And we've asked her here for a little advice on creating gorgeous outdoor spaces. Julie, thanks so much for being with us.
Virginia, what a treat.
Thank you. I just recently, like many homeowners, realize that I have a yard. And I'm thinking about what a lot of us are thinking about, what we want in terms of our gardens and what we want them to look like aesthetically.
Yes.
Now, you make a point. It's not aesthetics only. It's about the feeling.
You know, for me, feeling comes before function. Form follows function. Yes, that's always been said in architectural circles. But when you think about it, the even deeper place that is more important to really access and get outright is the feeling. What feeling do you want to have in your backyard?
So you don't have an ideal, you don't have an idea of, you know, what feeling you get.
Well, I think in your yard, I think you have an ideal. And my problem as your designer, were I to be yours, is to figure out what that is. What are the images behind that feeling? Where does it all come from? And then combine your, what I call, inward garden with my inward garden and create something that no one's ever quite seen before.
Well, we're going to ask you a lot of questions, Julie. I know you work all over the country, all over the world even, but your design studio is based in Saxton's River, Vermont, so you understand the climate and the character. So first, do we have to wait till after black fly season?
No, we have to work around all the seasons we have. But certainly it's such a great moment to come outside, look again at your property, and understand what works for you and what doesn't. Whenever we walk on a new site, we do a little site analysis in our brain, if not on by plan, and figure out what are the obvious things that are glaringly bad, but also what are the things that really could change without too much work. Sometimes you have to take a shed out, for instance, and just bulldoze it to be able to get a good view. Sometimes you need to understand that you're facing north and nothing's going to grow next to your house. So you have to make adjustments, of course, for the site.
Some of the things that I hadn't thought about, testing your soil.
Very helpful.
Calculating wind.
Yes.
What do these do for your planning process?
Well, what we think about a lot is the fact that we have nor'easters and nor'westers here in the, Vermont and New England, and they're pretty frigid and difficult. So having evergreen trees that block you on those sides, if you're going to put evergreens in, a little screen of evergreens would help a lot to sort of counteract the forces of those. But then we have southwesterly winds in the summer that are the beneficial winds that keep us, from having to use our air conditioning. So we need to think about those things and how we site our houses.
Is this book for the DIY gardener or the pro or people like me who just have pure lust?
I think it's for everyone because there's a little bit of inspiration for sure in these beautiful photographs. But we also very carefully selected projects that were not over the top. You know, so many people are afraid to even start doing anything, Virginia. It's scary for people to walk outside. For some reason, they feel fine with doing things inside their house, painting the walls, moving the furniture around. But because there are no walls outside and there's sky without a ceiling and, something soft underfoot, people get scared. But the best thing to do is just start. Dig a little piece of your yard up and start planting. And you're going to fail on some of them. Nothing's perfect. But being able to understand that you've made a little corner of beauty is really what it's all about.
I wonder if that also has something to do with, how we look on the outside versus how it feels to be on the inside.
Yeah, you mean
insides are sanctuaries, you know, our outdoors are on display, so there's a different kind of self-judgment even about them.
Well, especially in the front.
Yeah.
And one thing I always say to people is think about your front yard as though it's a backyard, and suddenly it becomes all the possibilities are there. You could create a little terrace with some Adirondack chairs and invite your neighbors to come sit with you if you like them. You know, you could sit outside yourself in the front yard. And with space sort of decreasing in terms of, you know, having less space in, for most of us in our own on our own properties, the front yard becomes an important place to develop as well, not just leave it as a big lawn.
We've talked with some people who have edible front lawns.
That's right.
You know, maybe not as necessary here in rural New England, but the edible front lawn. What are some of the things that one would have to consider in doing an edible garden in the front?
Well, the main thing is the sun.
Yeah.
And that's why people often have them in the front yard. We've got some nice examples in the book. And the reason, of course, they're there is it's the best location to be able to get, you know, all day sun, which you really need for most vegetables. And then, of course, you need to ameliorate the soil if you're going to do that. And it's important if you're going to put vegetables in the front yard to think about some overall structure that gives it some beauty, too.
Mm-hmm. So structure meaning the length and or the height and depth of these plants?
The height and depth, maybe the evergreen quality, like mm-hmm. put some boxwood behind where the little corner where the veggies are going so that when you harvest them, there's something that looks solid and good and as supports the whole design.
Other questions that came up about landscaping as we were talking about this internally, moss versus grass. Now, I know my dad, he's dug up his lawn several times to try and plant grass. It's just persistently moss. He's got a lot of evergreens and pines there. Just doesn't seem to want to be grassy.
He's lucky.
Really?
I mean, I love moss gardens.
But I do, too. I
lived in Japan for a while. Mm-hmm. And, of course, one thing that you see there are moss gardens in the meditation gardens that they have. The moss that's the easiest for us to transplant and to use, and that's the most kind of pedestrian-friendly, is haircap moss, it's called. And it's beautiful little velvety, almost looks like little trees. And you can walk on it just enough. You can't walk on it constantly, but you can lie on it. It's a beautiful moss, and it can take a lot of sun as well as a lot of shade.
But if you had kids who needed a playground, probably wouldn't want
moss. Still need a little lawn. And there's all, you know, I'm not averse to lawn. I think the thing to think about with it, though, is that think about it as though it's a pool of space so that it becomes the positive in the yard and that the beds around it define that pool of space, that lawn that's not water, but it almost looks like it's water in your backyard. And it becomes a kind of big terrace that's quite wonderful to walk on and becomes a space within itself.
Well, that's one of the subtle and interesting things about looking at these photographs. There's just defined senses of space. Is that part of how when you look, if you were to look at a vast green lawn, you might think about it in terms of creating little spaces inside of that?
Or a number of linked pieces of lawn, mm-hmm. or a river of lawn in a sense that's moving through your backyard that you can use as a path, but also as a place to be or a place to play. So, yes, gardens are malleable objects, but the big thing with it is to find a way to create a structure that looks great in the off times of the year. Some people want symmetry, so, you know, that's an easy way to start because you sort of know where to put every tree. If you put one here, you put the other one opposite it. That's somewhat easier. But a dynamic balance that you create that's done with asymmetry requires a lot of looking and thinking and kind of feeling as you do it.
Is there any difference in that approach and when you're walking around, you know, thinking of a big project like the Toronto Music Garden that you did with Yo-Yo Ma? I think it was based on one of the box suites.
That's right.
How does that musicality become a landscape?
Well, the way I think about it is, in a way, not every project has to have this, but most projects, to have a kind of uniformity to their design, need a big idea. And the big idea in the music garden was, as you say, the first cello suite by Bach. And it has six movements to this suite. And so I listened and listened to the music. And the music reminds everyone who listens to it of nature. So it was my job just to figure out what parts of nature. The prelude was all about river and stream. The Allemande was all about squirrel trails that swirled in and out. The Courant is about a big maze and a fabulous hillside of colorful places, colorful plants. And it went from there. So by having that idea of the music helped me design that garden. And, of course, talking to Yo-Yo about how he saw it as well. Mm-hmm. That created the garden and its kind of harmonies.
Oh, what a wonderful project. Do you have a favorite project or a favorite landscape that you visited?
Well, certainly that's one of my favorites, is the music garden, just because it was a big collaborative effort. Everyone who worked on that project, I played the music for, from the laborer to the concrete mixer. So we all were part of an idea, and everybody's talents helped me build that garden.
Well, one to inspire plenty of inspirational landscapes to look at in Julie's new book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
Landscape designer Julie Moyer Misservi. She's principal of Julie Moyer Misservi Design Studio and author of, among other books, Landscaping Ideas That Work. You'll find a link to see photographs of some of the gorgeous landscapes that she's designed, along with more on the Home Outside app and program. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Gardening not your ideal summer activity? Perhaps you'd rather break out the bicycle and hit the open road. These days, cycling enthusiasts have a lot of options when it comes to specialized equipment, but for some, simpler is just better. Producer Jonathan Menivar spoke with graphic designer Naz Hamid about the growing popularity of the fixed gear bike.
Most bikes have two shifters. Essentially, what it does is it just shifts the chain to cover all the different permutations of the gears. Typically on an older bike, like a 10-speed, there's two chain links up front. So there's a big one and a smaller one. And on the back, there's five, what you call cogs or a sprocket. So how it works is the bigger the chain link up front and the smaller the cog in the back, the harder the gear is. The fixed gear, it's a very simple machine. It doesn't have any gears except one. And that gear is the gear that you're always in. It's like when you were a kid and you had the little big wheel. In essence, that was a fixed gear because when you turned the pedals, the big wheel would go. And when you stopped, it wouldn't go. This is my newest bike. This is basically a Track Flame. And it has a much steeper and tighter geometry, so it's very twitchy. It's much more responsive, which is why a lot of messengers who ride in precarious situations in the city amongst cars, amongst traffic, choose the fixed gear style bike. Most people like to describe it as being sort of stealthy. It's incredibly quiet because the chain is lined up perfectly. Normal bicycles coast. You know, you pedal, you relax your feet, the bike goes, you pedal some more, it keeps going when you start slowing down. Fixed gears don't coast. So your legs are always going. There's no stopping, there's no relaxing them, they're just always in motion. It's a hurdle to overcome, mentally. But I think once you get it, it really becomes effortless. Because now you just have this idea that, oh, my legs are always in motion, they're always spinning. You don't have to think about gears. You don't have to think about switching. You just go and you stop. It just works. When you take a hill, you start to notice that you're slowing down. And you do have to work harder. Basically, you become the gear. You become the machine. And you really do feel one with the bike. You feel it through your legs, you feel it through the bike, it's right there. And I mean, it's a beautiful thing too. You do have to love it. And most people I know who really take the time to sort of figure out what it is do fall in love with it. For like, you know, a flat line like Chicago, it's just about perfect. It's not for everyone, that's all I gotta say.
That was fixed gear bike enthusiast Naz Hamid. The piece was produced by Jonathan Menivar. Come on, wheels, take this boy away. New Englanders are known for their frugality, never shy about seeking a bargain. Well, there is one place where you can find deals that beat out the competition every time, and it ain't Walmart. I'm talking about New Hampshire's many town transfer stations, or as just about everybody calls them, the dump. Mike Morin is a writer and a columnist and co-host of WZID's New Hampshire in the Morning show. His article, Finding Treasure at New Hampshire's Transfer Stations, was published in New Hampshire Magazine. We're so pleased to have you with us, Mike.
Thank you, Virginia. Good to be here.
Now, you couldn't get to all of the transfer stations in New Hampshire. Which ones did you visit for your article?
Actually, just three. Mm-hmm. I started in Hooksett, which is where the whole idea for the story began. Went to Bedford to the secondhand shop where Gus Papa John has a wonderful selection of gently used things. And then I went out to Peterborough and was amazed at the number of artists that actually congregate and, I don't want to say fight over the stuff, but they're all watching each other to get the best materials.
Wow, who knew?
Yeah.
Well, did you find much distinction between the material, the vibe at these different transfer stations?
That's a good question. The vibe was definitely very artsy in Peterborough. But the one that really got me most interested was the very first one in Hooksett. And I used to live in Hooksett. And as I was moving last summer, I started hauling all my belongings I didn't want. And I looked around the walls and the beams are on this giant metal building where you back your car in. Mm-hmm. And it was nothing but Tonka trucks.
What?
Hundreds of Tonka trucks parked bumper to bumper like rush hour traffic. And I had to find out more about that and talk to Diane Boyce, who is now the superintendent of recycling in Hooksett. And she said people started dropping them off 25 years ago, and one became two. And it was almost like rabbits. They multiplied because people would bring them down so they could come back and see their collection. And, oh, that's my truck over there on the wall.
Okay. We're saying recycling and transfer stations. Are we ever going to get beyond dump? I mean, really?
Well, I guess people that really grew up here – call it the dump. I grew up in Detroit, well, which, by the way, is a dump, but that's a whole different story. And we just had your curbside pickup. So I did move here having called it the dump, but I felt I should be a little politically correct and respectful since these people love their jobs.
Well, you are speaking to, you know, the Tonka trucks, for example. Mm-hmm. That speaks to a kind of regularity and frequency of going to the transfer station. I'm going to take your cue here. But is that what makes them such integral parts of communities? I mean, it's a place where people really have conversations. They stop. They dilly-dally, even though they're doing errands.
That's very true, Virginia. Once you get beyond the stuff, it is about conversation, and it's a very social setting. It's almost like a bar without the drinks. And even politicians always make it a point during election season to make sure they get out there Saturday morning and shake those dirty hands and get some votes.
So tell us about some of the people that you met at New Hampshire's transfer stations. One terrific
character. This is really
character.
Hard for you, isn't it?
One terrific character, Gus Papa John. What's he do?
I love Gus. He is the guy that oversees and runs the second chance shop, as they call it. And it's actually a way to help defray the cost of recycling materials or getting rid of stuff in the town. They take some of the proceeds and feed it back into the system. But he essentially is in charge of going out when people call and say, I have such and such, come out and look at it. If he thinks it's worth it, he'll pick it up and bring it to his second chance shop. And when I was in there one day, it was literally closed, but people still knock on the door. They ignore the close sign and they say, do you have ice skates or do you have, you know, a chandelier or whatever? So it really is a very compelling place and he has the perfect personality for it.
All right. You discovered, as you mentioned, several artists, especially around Peterborough. Was it just Peterborough?
It was. I wasn't aware of any other artistic type folks. When I was looking into wanting to go to Peterborough, I just Googled, you know, Peterborough artists, found a guy by the name of Stephen Graves who said, oh, I'll take you on and introduce you to all my friends because we all, you know, we all trash pick and we all build cool stuff out of the recycled materials. And so he was kind of my tour guide and brought me to a number of the other people I met.
Another artist you met is called Scott Bradford. What's his story?
Well, he's really a recycling director for the town of Peterborough first and secondly an artist of birdhouses. So he finds the wood and the materials that people drop off, and he builds these beautiful birdhouses that started out just for family and friends, and now He goes to craft shows and he's in boutiques and he probably makes over 100 of them a year just because he loves doing it. Mm. I don't think it's for the money.
Wow, there's a beautiful photograph of him in the article, proudly holding a birdhouse. He actually won the Recycler of the Year award. Now, who gives that out?
I'm not really sure if there's a state agency or maybe it's a trade association, but this man takes so much pride in the way the premises look. Now, I went during January to do the story, and I couldn't see the landscaping, but apparently he says the people come from all around to take a look at how beautiful it is. You wouldn't think that, including sister cities of Peterborough, Ontario, and Peterborough, England. People have come just because.
Wow. Okay, so next they're going to start to transition the name to Gardens, Transfer Gardens.
Maybe. That could be next.
I'm speaking with the writer and radio personality Mike Morin about digging for hidden treasure at New Hampshire's transfer stations. Now, Mike, we would like to turn to one of the treasure hunters that you spoke with for your article. This is the picture framer and the artist Jane Simpson. Jane, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
So which transfer station do you frequent and what are you looking for?
I go to the Peterborough transfer station and also to the Dublin transfer station, and I am just open to whatever I see that catches my eye.
How long have you been doing this, Jane, and how often do you go?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know that I could put my finger on how long I've been going, but I probably go to the dump once a week. I recycle all of the packaging from my frame shop, so I accumulate quite a bit of paper and cardboard, and I bring that all to the transfer station.
What's one really surprising thing that you've discovered at your local transfer station?
Well, the item that is featured in the magazine, I found a beautiful photograph of the Dorchester High School for Girls from 1929, and it's a beautiful photograph, and it has hundreds of images of these young, hopeful faces, and it was in the, ready to be thrown away, and I plucked out images and turned them into jewelry.
Has anyone ever looked at something that you've gotten from the transfer station, asked you about it, and been kind of grossed out by it? I mean, any stigma against these gently recycled items?
No. Just the opposite, surprise, like, wow, really? Like they'd never thought to look for good things at the dump before.
Right now, this is so popular. I mean, this is a story that Mike definitely picked up on, but, you know, is it the economy? Is it more material to recycle? What?
I know when I go to the transfer station, I am amazed at the things that are there that are still perfectly usable. And I think we've just become much more conscious of throwing things away that can be, someone else can use them. So why not put it in a place where people can look and see and reuse it?
Mike, I think we've won her over. She started with dump and now is on to transfer station.
I'm trying to be.
It's really catching.
She's very much a romantic, though. And what stuck with me, Jane, when I was talking with you, is you like the thought of using something that somebody else has touched or used or seen, and it almost connects you to a different or an older time.
Absolutely. That's the way I think about these little photographs that I've made into earrings. I feel like, oh, these beautiful girls, who are they? And how can they just be thrown away? And it's exciting to think that, they're going to live on.
Okay, Mike, after encountering Jane and so many people, the romance of the transfer station, you going to go to all of the transfer stations, not stop at three?
Well, if somebody would like to underwrite a project where I could investigate and become a full-time garbologist, I'd be all over that.
But you're not quitting your day job yet.
Not yet, but I might be convinced.
Mike Morin, what a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Mike Morin is a writer and columnist and co-host of WZID's New Hampshire in the Morning. His article, Finding Treasure at New Hampshire's Transfer Stations, was published in New Hampshire Magazine. Jane Simpson, picture framer and artist who creates new works from recycled materials found at the Peterborough Transfer Station. Jane, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Now, there is a link to see Mike's story where you can get some great pictures of all the people and transfer stations that we mentioned and many more. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like to know from you, do you love going to your town dump? Want to make a case for why yours is the best? Tell us what you found there and what makes your transfer station so distinctive. You can go to our Facebook page or our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word up!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 2014 marks 50 years since the Wilderness Act became law, placing more than 9 million acres of federal land into production and creating a legal definition of the word wilderness, which is really quite poetic. I quote, "A wilderness in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain." Among the protected lands was a section of the Sierra Nevada mountains bordering Yosemite National Park, then called the Minarets Wilderness. In 1984, the name was changed to the Ansel Adams Wilderness after the visionary photographer and wilderness preservationist, famous for beautiful black and white photographs of the craggy peaks and high alpine meadows and lakes of his beloved Sierras. Joining us now is award-winning photographer Peter Essick. His new book is called The Ansel Adams Wilderness, and it's an homage to Adams, published to coincide with the Wilderness Act, and features Essick's own photos of the High Sierra. Peter, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You dedicate this book to your father, who I guess first introduced you to the High Sierras. Can you tell us anything about those trips with your dad?
Yes. My father was sort of one of the first backpackers. He was a high school science teacher, so we had the summers off. And so I grew up in Southern California, and we used to go up into this area of the Sierras. So that was my first experience with this area.
So you had seen them in person before you saw Ansel Adams' photographs of them?
Yes, I went there in high school, and then it was in my senior year in high school was when I took a photography class and got acquainted with the black and white darkroom and then discovered the work of Ansel Adams.
Well, since this is radio, of course, we cannot see your photographs. We do have a link to look at some of them at wordofmouthradio.org. But can you give us a kind of overall description or some special spots even for you in the Ansel Adams Wilderness?
Well, there's one area called Garnet Lake, and it's a picture that's on the cover of the book where in the afternoon in the summertime, thunderclouds build up, usually 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's the weather that comes off of the Pacific, and when it hits these tall Sierra mountains, it builds up the moisture, and then usually you'll have a rainstorm and kind of a dramatic lighting for a photographer because the sunlight can kind of burst through the clouds and it can even be sunny and raining at the same time. To me, that's sort of emblematic of some of the drama that you see in the Sierras, what John Muir called the range of light.
It is something else. There's also, you can see the wind on the surface of the lake, I think, building up. So you used a digital camera. We read of Ansel Adams lugging his large format cameras around on a burro. So you weren't there to sort of retrace his steps or mimic. How do you distinguish what you did from Adams' own work?
I thought a lot about that. As far as the using the 4x5 view camera and film, black and white film like he did, I thought about doing that, but then I realized that Ansel Adams always tried to use the latest technology available. He thought of looking at the scene, and you were trying to show how it felt or how you saw it and sort of your emotional response to it. And the technology was just you would use the best technology available to try and achieve that. I wanted to try and make it also my own and also contemporary to the different feelings that we have toward wilderness now.
But of course, now we have all this in front of us and we have an awareness of the wilderness as a protected area while technology and sprawl and highways have, you know, taken over so much of America. Can you see it with completely fresh eyes?
Well, I think it's different eyes. Adams believed in modernism, that technology would make life better. And he also believes that art should be an affirmation of life. So for him, going up into the Sierras the discovering a love of nature sort of changed his whole life and gave him meaning. And so he wanted to portray that in his pictures. The difference now is we know that the American West is not an unspoiled wilderness. There is all this development. But these wilderness areas now are just sort of these special reserves that we can go to. And we're finding out they are, you know, repositories of a lot of ecological wisdom, so to speak.
My impression, looking at Ansel Adams' photographs and, you know, seeing posters through the years on college dorm walls or offices or that kind of thing, is that Ansel Adams has given so many people a vision of what it's like to be in these outdoor, these just incredible environments without having ever been there. What do you think that means for his legacy?
Well, I think that's what he was trying to do. He called the pictures, he called them extracts, and that they were extracting a part of nature, and it was all that he had seen and felt at the time. And that's what he thought his art should do, is to sort of take those feelings, those emotions that he had about the wilderness, and transfer them to a photograph. So his feelings about wilderness were all positive and transforming. So he wanted to try and convey that through his work.
Peter Essick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Peter Essick was recently named one of the 40 most influential nature photographers in the world by Outdoor Photography magazine. He's been a contributor to National Geographic for 25 years. His new book is called The Ansel Adams Wilderness, and it's a collaboration between National Geographic Books and the Wilderness Society. You can find some of these fantastic shots from the book at wordofmouthradio.org. New Hampshire wildlife officials are wrestling with a proposal that would put them in charge of wolf hybrids. Those are wolves that have been bred with domesticated dogs. These sometimes dangerous animals are often abandoned because they can become unmanageable as pets. NHPR's Sam Evans Brown reports that a population of abandoned wolf dogs prompted this latest look at an animal that falls squarely in the gray area between wild and tame.
Most dogs have many generations of domestication between them and their wild roots. Wolf dogs have just a few.
They have that wildness to them that's just hard to get out of them.
Tanner Brewer manages the state's largest wolf dog sanctuary in Chatham, up on the Maine New Hampshire border near Conway. He'll tell you that many wolf dogs act just like dogs, whimpering and begging for attention. But they can be huge, some weighing more than 200 pounds, and that wildness sometimes is right on the surface.
We have one wolf dog over here named Rosie that has really taken a liking to me and Matthew, but yet one of the other guys can't even go in the cage. So, and it just goes to show you, you know, I mean, he'd been in there three or four times, and she got his boot one day, you know, just bit his boot.
Brewer, a big guy and an Army vet, works for the New England Wolf Advocacy and Rescue Center, or NEWARC. He says the 69 animals here have all been spayed or neutered and vaccinated, which the law requires. They're kept in large pens with 8-foot chain-link fences. It was a quiet, sunny day when I visited NEWARC, but in reality, there are storm clouds surrounding this refuge. Last fall, a different wolf sanctuary in Alexandria collapsed, prompting a lot of headlines and scrutiny from lawmakers over how these animals are regulated. Basically, right now, they're treated roughly like domestic dogs. They have to be licensed with local authorities. The Department of Agriculture has rules that require wolf hybrid owners to neuter, vaccinate, and keep them in pens with tall fences, but Ag says it has never enforced these rules because it doesn't have the resources to do so.
Good morning, Glenn Normando, Director of Fish and Game.
The Ag Department says it should be up to Fish and Game, which at a recent hearing said it too has money problems.
You know, we don't have the manpower or the money to be going around confirming that somebody's wolf hybrid is neutered, or that it to look and see what kind of pens people have for these animals. I mean, that's not what
our department does.
Wait, says Fish and Game. These are domestic animals. That's not our deal. And agriculture says, no, no, really, they're wild animals. They should be managed by Fish and Game. And meanwhile, wolf dogs continue to trickle into the state. You can still import wolf hybrids from out of state, and it's illegal to sell them in New Hampshire, but a quick Google search will show you that doesn't mean it's not happening. Refuges like Newark and the one in Alexandria exist because when someone's adorable hybrid puppy grows into a 200-pound sofa-shredding wolf dog, it needs a place to go. But these sanctuaries often operate hand-to-mouth, on the fringes of towns. Donald Sullivan is the chief of police in Alexandria, which hosted the refuge that fell apart so publicly last fall.
The owners of that property wound up getting evicted from the land, which left me in a very tough spot of having a massive amount of these wolf hybrids up on the side of the mountain that I knew the owner was not going to be able to properly remove.
It took 16 days to deal with 40 abandoned dogs. Some had to be euthanized, and a few went to the Humane Society, and the rest went to Newark.
Hi, babies. Hi, babies. What you
Brewer
doing?
Is part of a crew of three from California who recently took over in Chatham. They cobble things together to make it work financially.
Grants and volunteers and donations.
And it's a pretty rustic site, way up on the side of a ridge.
So when we came here, it was just a melee of tools and stuff that had been left behind, people living in trailers everywhere. And we want to get rid of all that, you know, and be able to make some suitable housing.
The Chatham Sanctuary used to be called the Lokai Clan Wolf Refuge. Its founder, Fred Keating, had run-ins with the USDA, who cracked down on him for charging for tours of the site, which technically made it an illegal zoo. Keating fed the animals roadkill and whatever other meat he could rustle up. The refuge's board of directors eventually kicked him out, saying the animals weren't getting proper veterinary care. When Brewer and the others arrived last fall, they found a pile of animal carcasses on the property, years old and including some of the wolf dogs.
This was a boneyard down here that we cleared out and made pens, but every animal had two bullet holes in the head, so that leads you to believe that the animals were still alive when they were brought here.
Now they're building new enclosures, getting the animals on site vaccinated and neutered, and trying to attract new resources. And they hope to do that by employing veterans. According to Matt Simmons, the co-founder of the California refuge that took over in Chatham, it's a model that has worked out west. Simmons is writing grants and trying to start a program called Wolves and Warriors. It works through the VA to hire traumatized veterans to care for rescued wolf dogs.
They'll be able to live at the facility free of charge. They will also get paid while they are there. We will bus them back and forth for medical appointments, and we will give them a chance to heal clean and sober and outside the brick and mortar of the VA hospital.
Meanwhile, a fix for the oversight of wolf dogs in New Hampshire appears to be hung up in the politics of how to enforce the law. Though Simmons thinks simply levying the $1,000 fine for infractions might not be enough.
Some of these animals fetch a price of $10,000 per puppy. When you have eight pups in a litter, why would you care? That's just the cost of doing business.
And while wolf dogs can be difficult pets to own, some people still continue to want to take on that challenge. Ellen Finnessy from Ackworth shared her story with lawmakers.
The family of a friend of our son's when he was about five had a wolf hybrid named Rosie. She was the sweetest thing in the world. She wagged her tail. She was just like a dog.
The bill tweaking the New Hampshire rules is already through the Senate and will be up for a vote in the House in the coming weeks. Whatever lawmakers decide, there are 69 wolf dogs on the Maine New Hampshire border where they'll live out their lives.
You know, it's our responsibility. We made them this way. So we made them this way, so they have a right to live just like anything else, you know. And as long as there's places that are available like Newark, then it makes no sense to even think about putting them down.
So for now, they'll be there for wolf dog owners who find they've bitten off a little more than they can chew.
Wolf mother, where you been? You look so warm, so thin.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
You're a taker, devil's maker. Let me hear you sing, hey, yeah, hey, yeah. Wolf mother at the door.
Thank you for spending some of your precious summer hours with us today. We hope our great outdoor show inspired you to throw on your hiking shoes or dig out the gardening gloves or create your own playground. And if you happen to take a trip to your local transfer station, don't forget, we're asking you to make a case for why your dump is the best in the region. Tell us about the unusual treasures that you found there, or maybe the connections you've made with your neighbors and community whilst emptying the trash. You can leave a comment or throw down the glove on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. You never know what you're going to find by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Monday at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.